Well, thank you, Tom, and good afternoon to all of you. That was just a wonderful introduction, and I hope that you've had the time also to get to know Tom Doerr during this conference. He's been a wonderful educator, an innovator, an advocate for renewable energy and certainly U.S. grains and rural development, and best of all, a wonderful friend over the years, and I really appreciate that introduction. You know, it's wonderful for me to be here today, not only outside of Washington, but out with real people, real concerns, away from some of the pundits and the spinmeisters who are really working overtime in Washington, D.C. these days. But of course, you know, you are here in Illinois, and we have our own share of political stories, as witnessed by this billboard. It's actually a little spoof on what's actually happening. Our governor is no longer Rod Blagojevich, but if you haven't been able to see him on TV, you will sometime soon because he still keeps popping up everywhere. So there's a lot going on, but I have to tell you, I've been covering Capitol Hill since the early 1990s, and I have never, ever seen so much political polarization. You know, you've got the liberal left side of the party, and then you've got the more conservative wings of the party, and that's just within the Democratic Party. When you look at the Republican Party, you have some of the same polarization between the extreme fiscal conservatives, a lot of the Tea Party movement, and those who are more liberal on social issues. Now, as Tom mentioned, I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and I'm still very active in some of the management of that farm, but primarily, I consider myself a small business owner, and my business just happens to be publishing an electronic newsletter and a website. But this is my sixth year of business, and I know that one of the biggest issues facing business owners like me is the uncertainty. There's a lot of uncertainty right now, and whether you're running an ethanol plant or a feedlot or working on importing distiller dried grains, you have to realize that uncertainty is really problematic to your ability to plan and to make long-term investments. And this reminded me of a story about a preacher I know who was worried about the future, trying to find out for certain what was going to be the future for his teenage son. And it's a story that I can relate to because my husband, Al Johnson, who's here with me today, we have two college-age sons, and there's been a lot of times we're wondering what's going to happen with them and whether or not how they're going to turn out after they get through college. But this preacher decided he was going to do a test. So as his son went off to school one day, he laid out four items in the son's bedroom. One was a Bible, thinking that if the son picked up the Bible, he would be ultimately a preacher like the dad. Another one was a silver dollar. And the preacher was thinking, well, it wouldn't be too bad if he would pick up the silver dollar because he might be a banker or a businessman or someone who is wise with his money. He also laid out two other items, a bottle of whiskey and a Playboy magazine. And then he waited until the son came home from school and he was hiding behind the door to see which items the son might pick up so he could ascertain what the son would be doing in his future. So the boy comes home, the preacher's peeking from around the back of the door. First thing he picks up is the Bible. The preacher is delighted, thinks, you know, the Lord has smiled down upon him that his son will turn out to be a preacher. But the son continues around these items that have been laid out around his room, and he looks at that shiny silver dollar and thinks that's pretty good too, and he sticks that in his pocket. He continues, and then he sees the bottle of whiskey. Gotta check that out, being an inquiring young man, takes a big swig. All of a sudden, the preacher starts to have his heart sink. He doesn't know what's gonna happen, but he's afraid now that the son could turn out to be a boozer. The son continues looking around the room, spots the Playboy magazine, and of course, ooh la la, has to open up the centerfold, and who said you just look at the interviews and those things? He wants to check out the photography. By this time, the preacher is just heartbroken. He says, oh, you know, Lord have mercy. Now I know with certainty what my son is going to be. He's going to be a congressman. So it is difficult sometimes in the search for certainty, but one of the good things, that just like that preacher, is the ethanol industry does have its own share of certainties. In fact, if you look at what's been happening since the Energy Act of 2005 and 2007, and you've got the Renewable Fuel Standard too now, we're going to be ramping up towards a 36 billion gallon goal by 2022. And as you've likely heard throughout the conference, the Environmental Protection Agency, bearing something really uncertain, is likely to approve a waiver to go to E15 later this month. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to immediately start blending levels at E15, but it puts us on a pathway towards a more certain future for higher ethanol blends, at least on newer vehicles. A decision on older model vehicles might not come until the end of the year. So, yeah, it'll take some time to implement, but those are a couple of certainties for the ethanol industry that I think we can all agree are pretty good. And in recent weeks, it's been fascinating for me to watch what's been happening with the administration on renewable energy. Some of you might have seen, picked up in the airport on your travels here, that the president did an interview with Rolling Stone magazine. And this was one of his quotes. "One of my top priorities next year is to have an energy policy that begins to address all facets of our over-reliance on fossil fuels. We may end up having to do it in chunks as opposed to a comprehensive omnibus legislation, but we're going to stay on this because it's good for our economy, it's good for national security, and ultimately it's good for the environment." Good stuff. And then he was asked a question a little later on in the interview about, do you see a point at which you're willing to throw the whole weight of your presidency behind this, like you did on health care reform? And we know what a big kahuna piece of legislation that was. And he said, yes, not only can I foresee it, but I am committed to making sure that we get an energy policy that makes sense for the country and helps us grow. At the same time, it deals with climate change in a serious way. Of course, he was playing to the very liberal base that would be the readership of Rolling Stone, but I think very supportive comments for this industry. You probably also heard from Bob Anin or some of the others at Renewable Fuels about the meeting that they had in Washington where the policy advisor, Heather Zeichel, said some really supportive things about the administration's commitment to ethanol. And of course, we're looking at the new chief of staff, maybe just on an interim basis, but the new chief of staff at the White House is Peter Rouse, who cut his political teeth in Washington with a South Dakota congressman before moving back to Berkeley Bedell, whom Tom and I would have known in his early years, and then spending 18 or 19 years with Senator Tom Daschle. So he's got ethanol politics in his blood. So there's been a lot happening from the White House, and even USDA got into the act a little bit last week, and I found this kind of fun in a news media sort of way. USDA issued a release, a new blog. The headline was, USDA report shows improving corn ethanol efficiency. And, you know, I'm looking at that going, that seems familiar. Have I seen this before? And, you know, Keith Williams is here, used to work at USDA Communications. You know, a lot of stuff moves through their shop, but golly, I called up and they said, well, we don't think we've seen this blog before. But when you went to the Office of Chief Economist, you found out they issued it first in June. But a lot of other news outlets didn't check, and so USDA got a bunch more headlines, like they got a brand new report just a couple of months later. So a lot of these things are moving in a direction where you can see that the administration is starting to ramp up for a big agenda on renewable energy for next year. But even given that, there's a lot of uncertainty, and that's where I'd like to go kind of focus on five key issues today with share with you some of the uncertainty that's dealing with our political turmoil, the midterm elections, what's going to happen in the 112th Congress, as much as we can tell, the federal deficit challenges, and some of the potential speed bumps ahead. Now, regardless of your political perspective, it's obvious that the polarization I referenced earlier is becoming hazardous to anyone's health in Congress. You know, there's a new definition for endangered species. It's called incumbent. There's a lot of folks that are worried, and rightfully so. I was at a rally on Capitol Hill about 3 weeks ago, and this was one of the signs that was waving around by the Capitol. You know, don't give them all the points for spelling, but creativity, I thought they ranked pretty high. And it doesn't matter if it's Nancy Pelosi or Sarah Palin. I mean, there's a lot of polarization right now, and it's making it difficult for anyone within parties sometimes and between parties to get things done. There's kind of a dysfunctional environment right now where even bills that seemingly should have passed and could have passed are in a holding pattern. Now, since 2009, the Senate has failed to take up about 350 bills that have been passed by the House. Now, I know the Senate is known for being that body that lets things simmer, but you know, that's kind of a long time. Some of those things are going to start to smell. And you can easily see why the American public has become sickened. I mean, they're just sick of things not getting done. And they're sick of the inability to compromise. And time again, we saw these opportunities for Congress to act, and it just wasn't happening. And you'd hear basically three different responses on why things weren't getting done if you go up to a member of Congress. Well, the measure was an offset, so we can't support it. That means it wasn't paid for by a reduction someplace else. There was a procedural problem, like it wasn't the correct order that they wanted to consider it. And then thirdly, just the political gamesmanship that goes on when a member of one party does not want a member of the other party to score political points. Extension of the biodiesel tax has been a pretty good example and perhaps a precursor to what could happen on ethanol tax incentives, especially if the industry is not careful. You know, we've got an incentive for biodiesel that expired at the end of last year, and you had all sorts of supporters saying, oh yeah, we're gonna bring that back. Now, it wasn't going to be offset, but in the whole scheme of things, the price tag's relatively small, under $900 million for 10 years. But at the same time, you had, of course, more people worried about how it was going to be paid for, and you had this uncertainty with this gamesmanship going on in Congress. So I talked to Democrats who would say, yes, yes, we're going to get this biodiesel tax incentive renewed, even if it's just retroactive for a year, we're going to do this. And Republicans would say the same thing. Yes, it's on our top list. And we have an economy in the United States where unemployment is hovering around 10%. So these people would say, yes, we want to have jobs. We want to have green jobs. But Senator Chuck Grassley, who's from Iowa, tried twice this year to bring it up as a standalone, and again last month to attach to the small business bill, which did move, and he couldn't find enough votes. All of those folks who have said again and again and again to the biodiesel industry, yes, we're going to support your tax incentive, didn't show up. And even some of the traditional folks, like North Dakota Senator Kent Conrad and Byron Dorgan would almost always support biodiesel. They first voted no before they flipped their vote at the end of the voting period when they knew that they were safe. So what's giving on this whole thing? Why the problem? I tried to get as many people on the record as I could on this one to see where it was going to go in the future. Now, Senator Dick Durbin, who's very high up in the leadership in the Senate from Illinois, they told me this. Well, the Grassley Amendment was a procedural vote on a motion to suspend the rules to allow for consideration of an amendment that did not relate to the bill that was being considered. Had the motion passed, it might have stalled progress on the small business bill, and the Senate had been working on this. And I got almost the same talking points from Senator Debbie Stabenow out of Michigan and Sherrod Brown out of Ohio, and even Tim Johnson out of South Dakota. Same sort of gobbledygook, that it was a procedural issue and they just, golly, couldn't take it up. Well, we all know damn well that if they wanted to do it, they could have gotten it done. They use these things all the time. There is certainly no reason why this couldn't have moved, except for the people who had problems with the offsets. That would have been, I consider, you know, a valid excuse. And could there have been a procedural motion to find an offset? But you can see why the American public gets fed up when things that have broad-based support just don't move for political reasons. So we're going to see what happens. November 2nd is the big midterm election here, and we've got all the House seats as well as a third of the Senate up for grabs. The GOP needs 39 to reclaim the majority in the House and 10 seats in the Senate to reclaim the majority there. You have to understand, the party holding the White House will typically lose seats, especially when the presidential approval rating is below 50%, as it is this year. So the question is not whether the party, the Democrats, will lose seats in the House, it's how many. Now, we put together a little chart based on Gallup polling data that basically shows that since World War II, only Presidents Clinton in 98 and Bush in 2002 actually saw gains in the midterm. Both men had approval ratings of about 60% at that time, but in 93, Clinton's approval slid, and that's when the Democrats lost 53 seats. And that's the fear this year, that history will be revisited with President Obama, whose approval rating is hovering 40-45%, depending on which rating you see. But of course, handicapping the midterms is always a crapshoot. You know, conventional wisdom from most of the political pundits I read or talk to is that the GOP will gain a majority in the House. They'll get 39 seats plus. Hardly anybody thinks that the GOP will take the Senate. But, you know, we've seen a lot of wacky political things this year, for lack of a better word. Who would have thought that Scott Brown would take the Senate seat in Massachusetts that had been held by Senator Ted Kennedy and the Democrats for so many years? Who would have thought that Republicans would take the governorships in Virginia and New Jersey? So, you know, there's a sort of a feeling that anything could happen, and especially in the midterms when voter turnout is usually low. The GOP kind of has that enthusiasm factor going right now, and some people might call it the fed up factor. They just want to get out and see this change. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat as an incumbent, your approval ratings are very low to begin with. I do think that there is some more enthusiasm starting to build right now among the Democratic Party. I'm on listservs for a lot of different folks, and this last week I started out with getting fundraising letters for $5 from Joe Biden so I could fight corporate interests with Joe, and then the First Lady sent me a note, Al Franken sent me a note, and yesterday the President sent me a note asking for $3, so the amount had gone down over the week. But you know, they're in full campaign mode right now, and I think there is a resurgence among the Democrats, but we'll see whether or not it's too late. So we're going to wake up November 3rd, survey the damages, see what's going to happen in both parties, and then I think we have to watch very carefully, because the members of Congress will come back November 15th for what is known as a lame duck session. And during that time, they're also going to have Thanksgiving break, and then Christmas will be coming right around the corner, and nobody likes to stay in Washington when they could be home with their families. So you may have just a couple of weeks in order to do an awful lot of work. The to-do list is incredibly long. All the appropriations bills have yet to be passed. Child nutrition, food safety, other major initiatives have been stalled. And of course, that long list of tax issues, including extension of the 2001-2003, known as the Bush tax cuts. Estate taxes need to be figured out, and of course the ethanol tax blenders credit and the tariff. So my sense is there's going to be this one big jumbo effort, kind of a legislative Hail Mary, where they say, okay, we're going to extend everything for 1 year. And then let the 112th Congress sort out the mess. And it'll be a big one. Now, there's no guarantee that's going to happen. It certainly could be much more difficult given whatever the margins are on November 3rd. But I think there's a strong likelihood that they could at least get a one-year extension of a lot of things passed. In some respects, the elections are going to make your job much more challenging. And here's why. You are going to have dozens of new members who may know or may not know anything about corn production, may not understand the dynamics of trade, may not know anything about DDGs, or certainly not understand the benefits of ethanol. So there's going to be a big educational curve as we ramp up with the new members of Congress in the 112th. And a lot of different dynamics on the committees. Now again, if you believe the pundits and the Republicans take over, they'll gain the leadership of key House committees. We'll lose Henry Waxman, co-author of the Waxman-Markey American Clean Energy Act. And the ranking minority member is currently Representative Joe Barton from Texas. Now, he stepped in it a little bit with some of the leadership in his comments over the BP oil spill, and it's not certain that the leadership will retain him as committee chair if they gain the majority. So then you have to look at, perhaps what will happen next, and that could be Ralph Hall, again, another Texan, a former Democrat, who joined his GOP colleagues in trashing the Waxman-Markey climate change bill. He's been a big sponsor of energy legislation early in the decade, but as you can imagine from his Texas roots, been very active on supporting new drilling technologies and basically conventional energy sources. He supports drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, backs research and development on clean coal and nuclear energy. In a Ways and Means Committee, we've had Charlie Rangel, but of course he's under investigation right now for some ethics violations. And Sandy Levin of Michigan has been stepping in. If he steps down, we could see Dave Camp, a Republican from Michigan and someone who's been involved at least and aware of renewable energy efforts, taking over that committee. In the Senate, the Energy and Natural Resources Committee is going to go through a big shakeup because you have the four members of the GOP who just aren't even going to be in Congress anymore. Lisa Murkowski, who lost her primary, is running as a write-in candidate, but she's trailing about 25 points from the Tea Party candidate right now. Brown Beck out of Kansas is stepping down to run for governor of Kansas. And Bob Bennett of Utah lost his primary. Jim Bunning of Kentucky is retiring. You're also losing Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. So if the GOP gains 10 seats in the Senate, which is still a long shot, you could see North Carolina's Richard Burr stepping forward as a committee chair, unless, of course, he moves to the Committee on Veterans Affairs. And that leaves the next person in line to be John Barroso from Wyoming. You're going to have all these trade-offs, and certainly there's not a lot known about how everyone may act. With Republican control of the House, I think one sure thing is we're not going to see cap and trade. I can bet you dollars for donuts on that one. But the Republicans do have a strong background of working on renewable energy. Some of you may remember that George Bush, as a governor of Texas, was one of the leaders in wind energy and all things renewable, and actually played a real strong role in advancing it during his administration. So Republicans can buy the green jobs message, and I think that they're going to want to embrace what's happening in terms of renewables in a major way. The big question will be is how are they going to be impacted by Tea Partiers and fiscal conservatives who are now moving into positions of power? And that's why I think the number one issue facing renewable energy agenda going forward is going to be the growing federal deficit. This is what we're facing right now in the United States. $1.3 trillion deficit in 2010. Now, I started my writing career writing about millions and then billions, and now everything's kind of got a T in front of it. We are in what the Congressional Budget Office Director Doug Elmendorf said is a bleak federal outlook. It's unsustainable, and that's without having to deal with these tax cuts that we talked about a little bit earlier. It's really a dire situation when you look at it from a budget situation. And here's another chart that just shows you some of the challenges ahead. Now, this is the debt as a percentage of gross domestic product. And you can see today, one of the highest levels was during World War II, where we topped over 100%. There's two lines in this slide, the green dotted lines on the right-hand side, that show projections going forward out to 2030. The lower dotted green line assumes that we don't extend tax cuts, we don't extend a lot of popular programs beyond the current baseline. The higher number shows that we do extend those tax cuts. And you see that the numbers start to climb up towards 200% of GDP. Obviously unsustainable. Now, of course, this does assume rather tepid growth in the United States, and if we get growing again, it'd be a different scenario. But there really is a huge problem lining up against any new program or continuation of a lot of existing programs. You'll hear a lot of people talk about the fact that, well, we're just going to cut spending. We're going to cut spending in the United States budget, and we'll get our way out of this huge debt problem. It's not going to be that simple. As this box shows, this rectangular box in front of you now, spending is about 23%, the discretionary spending that we can cut back on, 23% of our problem. But then you look at Social Security at 22%, and Medicare at 17%, Medicaid 8%, defense at 15%, we know that number is going to be coming down a little bit, but just the interest on the federal debt, it's about 15% of the spending going forward. Clearly unsustainable. So deficit hawks are going to be looking for every cut possible, and ethanol, renewable energy are going to be part of that mix, part of the target. Now, some people remember what Bob Dineen probably told you earlier this week, or he's written about, and that's that DDGs, trade, corn production, ethanol production, all these things can be revenue creators. In fact, federal tax revenue generated by the production and use of ethanol totaled more than $8 billion in 2009, and that's more than $3 billion than the value of the tax credit. So there's a net gain. If you take that big picture approach, you can make a sales point for this. But there's going to be a lot of cost cutting. And it's not just going to be on tax incentives. It's going to be throughout the federal budget. You know, we're going to be looking at doing a farm bill pretty soon. It's 2012 is time for a new farm bill. Seems like the last one just got over and we haven't even implemented all of it yet. But here we are looking at a 2012 farm bill, and we have a very dire budget situation. At the same time, the way programs are worked in the Congress is that every program has its baseline spending. In the farm bill, there are 37 programs that expire, and a lot of them are in the energy title of the farm bill. Here's a list of some of these. A couple of the big ones are the Biorefinery Assistance Program, the Bioenergy for Advanced Biofuels, the Rural Energy for America program, or REAP, and then the Biomass Crop Assistance Program. In terms of their impact on your industry, in order to extend these programs beyond 2012, something else has to give, because there's no baseline going forward for these. They're part of the 37 that expire. And that creates some very interesting delicacies among how you're going to build political coalitions in order to move forward. Now, whether or not we'll move forward on this next year or not is still subject to speculation. Colin Peterson, who's the current chairman of the House Ag Committee, wants to get going. He's told everybody it'll be a baseline bill, no new money. He wants to write it in 2011. I had an in-depth interview with Frank Lucas last week, who's from Oklahoma. He would be the chairman if indeed the Republicans take control of the House. And he says, let's wait. 2011, the budget's still gonna stink. Maybe by 2012, we can write a farm bill then and we'll have a little better baseline. So we're gonna have to just see how all this kind of plays out and, you know, what the end game may be. Last but not least, I just want to share with you a few of the challenges going forward, some speed bumps on the path to renewable energy. And as Tom mentioned, I'm on the 25 by 25 steering committee. I've seen a lot of bumps along the road, and they're going to continue. Public perception remains a very big challenge. The bloom is off the corn ethanol rose, and it's going to continue to be under attack from environmentalists, from the food industry, from a lot of do-gooders in the Grocery Manufacturers Association. They're all going to be making points about the amount of food that is going into fuel. And even though the debate died down a little bit earlier this year, that crop report this morning, a lot more people are going to need to talk to Tom Doerr and find out what's really going on, because we visited with analysts this morning. We have the tape up on our website. They're saying that they anticipate we will soon see $6 corn and soybeans at $12 to $12.50. So there's going to be a lot of smart folks in the livestock industry who've already hedged their bets, but a lot of other folks who will be complaining, and complaining quite loudly. So those are going to be part of the challenges in terms of food versus fuel. There's going to be regulatory challenges, and also on the infrastructure going forward. But one of the biggest challenges, I think, from an advocacy standpoint, is the need to have more political support and have unified political support. Now, I want to have you consider one thing about the base of support thus far. Now, most of the ethanol advocates in Congress come from the Corn Belt. Now, this red area on this map shows you the traditional Corn Belt. When you do the math and you're looking at Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then you look at that in terms of votes in the House of Representatives, you're only talking about 76 votes. And when you broaden the Corn Belt, as we have all witnessed over the last few years, and you go out into the Dakotas, where on our farm up there, gosh, we had some 200 bushel corn a couple of years ago. You know, you expand out to the Dakotas and Kansas and Colorado, and you start adding up those states, and you see that you're up to 107 votes. And that's if every member of the state's congressional delegation votes with you. That means everybody here in inner city Chicago votes with you. Not likely to happen. So how do you broaden that base out to more geographies and capture more political support? Well, one of the ways is to look at where that product goes out of the United States. And this map shows you some of the major U.S. ports. And, I mean, you can slice and dice this a lot of different ways. You can look at states that consume products, and you can look at many different ways. But in this instance, you can see that if you could start to get folks in Texas and along the ports there, and Louisiana, and South Carolina, and build along those who are getting jobs because of the trade that's being created, then you start to capture votes in states like Texas, which has 32 seats. I don't think you're ever probably going to get California, even though there's even some ethanol plants there now. That's a tough state to be able to crack, but you could build a coalition that starts to attract people in Washington and Louisiana. And it made me think that perhaps the industry needs to build a new model of political support beyond some of the traditional advocacy groups so that you perhaps build on the measure that was enhanced by the National Cotton Council, where you have all sectors of the industry, from seed to final end user, working on building the coalition that can move ethanol even more forward than it has gained in the last few years. Of course, just getting all the existing players on the same page has been difficult. You know, there was a story that we had on our website this week talking about the new unified game plan that Renewable Fuels Association, Growth Energy, ACE, the American Ethanol Coalition, and the National Corn Growers have embraced as a way to go forward. But when we talked to each of those folks individually, it was hard to find that anybody was delivering exactly the same song. There was a lot of dissension in the choir. And it's going to take everybody working together to really make a dent in energy politics moving forward. So the last slide I'd just like to leave you with is something that's an age-old quote, but one that is probably more pertinent today than ever before. And that is that Ben Franklin told us during the early days of the Constitutional Convention in this country that we must indeed all hang together, or most assuredly, we shall all hang separately. I'd like to leave you with that thought today. I appreciate your attention and the invitation to be here with you, and I hope that you all have safe travels on your way home. Thank you very much.